devoted to C.S. Lewis. We really didn't plan it that way, but in fact it's turned out to be that way. The Socratic Club is organized and directed by Dr. David Calhoun of Gonzaga University's Philosophy Department. I'm going to do the introductions this afternoon very quickly for the simple reason that Dr. Calhoun is presenting, and he was too shy to introduce himself, so I'll do it for him. Come on in, gentlemen. All we can offer you is a place right there against the wall or something like that.
Okay. Hang out right here.
The way the Socratic Club usually organizes itself is that we'll have a presentation by someone, in this case Dr. Calhoun, and then we'll have a response that sort of opens up the discussion. That response was scheduled to be done today by Dr. Brian Clayton, but he's not feeling well, and so Richard McClellan is going to do that for us. Very briefly, Dr. Calhoun, you may not know this, but is from Louisiana, from New Orleans. He took his undergraduate degree at LSU and then went to graduate school at Northwestern. We can quickly tell that he's not a great fan of college football, going from LSU to Northwestern. Nevertheless, he took his doctorate there and has now teaches for Gonzaga. His specialty is ancient philosophy. The respondent, Richard McClellan, started out at Reed College and eventually took his doctorate at Cambridge. Via Princeton and Oxford. I guess there's something all very appropriate about this in that C.S. Lewis himself was part of the original Socratic Club. So here we're talking about Lewis and our Socratic Club. Dr. Calhoun's talk is going to be titled, Virtue in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia.
Okay, thank you. Thanks to all of you for coming today. I know it's final season and maybe you're looking for a little bit of diversion. Well, we'll try to manufacture some if we can today. I want to tell you what I plan to try to do. Since I usually direct the Socratic Club, it's usually my job to shepherd speakers and try to make them not speak too long. So I'll try to not speak too long myself, leave plenty of time for discussion. But the plan of argument I want to follow is as follows here. I want to look at what Lewis is trying to do in the Narnia Chronicles, sketch out briefly a classical account of what virtue is, look at how classical virtue theory gets adapted by Christian thinkers in particular, and then show how Lewis's Narnia as a Christian-inspired fantasy world frames questions of goodness in terms of virtue. And the way we'll do that is by looking at a few case studies in a fairly brief way. I wish I had more time to talk about the specifics of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, because it's a fascinating book. That's the book we're going to look at closely toward the end of the talk. What is Lewis doing when he writes the Chronicles of Narnia? Well, I found an interesting quote by J.K. Rowling talking about her own experience of the Chronicles of Narnia. She says, "I adored the Chronicles of Narnia when I was a child. I got so caught up I didn't think C.S. Lewis was especially preachy. Reading them now, I find that his subliminal message isn't very subliminal at all." So, according to Rowling's reading, Lewis is grinding an axe in telling the Narnia stories. He really is engaged in communicating a message that's not very subliminal. And we might think about what kind of argument would be behind a view like this. While the Narnia books are clearly Christian, perhaps The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe more than any of the other books, and the fact that they are children's books might suggest that Lewis means them to be something like evangelistic propaganda. If we can't get the kids in church, we'll ply them with fantasy and try to fool them into Christianity or something like that. As a matter of fact, if you've read anything by Philip Pullman, the His Dark Materials author, who's now kind of in the news because the first movie of the trilogy has just come out, this is essentially his view, that Lewis is an evil propagandist for Christianity, for theism. Well, what does Lewis himself have to say about what he's doing? He said in a brief blurb that he wrote once for one of his publishers to describe himself for his books, he wrote this: "I wrote the books I should have liked to read if only I could have got them. That's always been my reason for writing. People won't write the books I want, so I have to do it for myself." Now, I think that gives us an interesting insight into what he's thinking when he writes the Narnia stories. In fact, in his recent biography of Lewis, the Narnian, Alan Jacobs, points out that the time when Lewis was writing the Narnia stories was a very difficult time in his own life. He had achieved a measure of success both professionally as a professor of medieval literature, and also he'd achieved some popular renown as an apologist for Christianity. But his life at the time was really quite difficult for a number of reasons. And it's interesting to think about the fact that he's writing the stories not because he has a sudden urge to entertain children, but because his own imagination is so fertile that he finds this outlet. Lewis says something very interesting about what writing is all about, especially imaginative writing, in a preface that he wrote in a secondary treatment to Milton's Paradise Lost. He says, "When the old poets made some virtue their theme, they were not teaching but adoring. And what we take for the didactic is often the enchanted." I think that's really an interesting reflection on Lewis's own writing, because when he writes the Chronicles of Narnia, he's not so much interested in preaching or teaching, engaging in didactic use of imaginative literature. His objective really is a sense of his own imaginative enchantment, which comes out in, of course, the style of the Chronicles being fantasy themselves. Now, of course, since the stories are Christian stories, Christian virtues and principles are going to play a critical and central role in the stories. In fact, if you think about it the way I'm suggesting, it's surprising that Christian themes aren't more on the surface than they are. I mean, you do find, certainly, themes like the creation in The Magician's Nephew, and you find clear treatment of a sacrificial death in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, as I said, perhaps the clearest and most transparently Christian of the Chronicles. And you find related themes like the discussion of faith that occurs toward the end of The Silver Chair. But it's not surprising that they would be. If Lewis is writing an imaginative work, a work of enchantment that captures his own sense of adoration of the Christian worldview, then it's not surprising that Christian virtue and principles are going to play a role. Now, since the stories, of course, are stories of fantasy and adventure, a particular subset of Christian virtues, including virtues such as courage and faith, are going to loom particularly large. I've already mentioned faith and its role in The Silver Chair. As we're going to see in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, courage is something that pops up again and again, as you would expect in adventures when you're sailing into the unknown, fighting dragons, and so on and so forth. A further thing that we should notice is that since the main characters are children, the processes of character formation are central to the narrative. In other words, we see people who are in the process of being formed as persons, as human individuals. And so it's not surprising that Lewis would be thinking about this whole question of what kind of person are you, and indeed, what kind of person do you want to become? Those are questions that we find centrally addressed in all of the Chronicles, not just The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Let me say a little bit about classical virtue theory. If we're going to try to argue that this is all about, our talk today is about Aristotle and Narnia, we're looking for classical conceptions of virtue in Lewis's imaginative world, we need to know a little bit about what the classical conception of virtue is. while we associate virtue ethics with Aristotle, about whom I'll say something in just a moment, it really is fair to say that virtue ethics is a commonly shared set of ideas of the Greeks and Romans about ethical goodness. And really, it would be too narrow to say that they're specifically Greek and Roman ideas, because we find them in other cultures as well. But if we're just focusing on Greek and Roman literature, which has had a great influence over Western culture, we find that treatments of virtue or the virtues occur in works of literature, history, drama, philosophy. I probably could have kept going, but you get the picture. And going all the way back to Homer's Iliad, and including major works by pretty different kinds of authors throughout the Greek and Roman period. As I said, though, the classic articulation that we find of this is in Aristotle, in particular in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. As I said, though, I think it's really a good idea to keep in mind that, even though I titled my talk Aristotle in Narnia, it's fair to say that virtue ethics is much bigger than Aristotle. Aristotle's importance is in codifying and articulating a view of what virtue ethics is all about. And so it's helpful to take a look and see, what does Aristotle have to say about this? Well, what we're talking about when we talk about virtue is the Greek concept arete, which means excellence of character, and it often gets translated virtue. I like to think about it as excellence of character precisely because virtue is a word that's little used in contemporary discourse. Usually when we talk about virtue or the lack thereof, we mean something very narrow. For example, sometimes people mean by implication sexual morality when they talk about virtue, or say a person is not very virtuous, that's what they mean. Well, arete really is much broader than that, as we'll see. What is it? Well, virtue, or excellence of character, is the proper exercise of reason over appetite, desires, and feelings. It is a product of choices, actions, and habits. And indeed, you can think about character as the result of a kind of feedback mechanism. We make choices, our choices lead to actions, our actions produce habits, our habits then lead to states of character. And virtue has to do precisely with states of character, the kind of person that you are. But as I said, it's a kind of a feedback mechanism because it is the product of choices, actions, and habits. But at the same time, virtue involves a disposition to act in a particular way in the future. As Aristotle would say, the way to become courageous is by doing courageous actions. But having become courageous, I increase the likelihood that in the future I will choose to act courageously. Okay? It consists, as Aristotle says, in a mean state of character. I've already said it has to do with a state of character, a disposition. It's a mean, not because Aristotle always thinks that the best thing to do is the moderate thing. We'll talk about that toward the end of the talk. But Aristotle thinks when we think about states of character, we can always see them as middle grounds between vicious excesses and defects. Let me give you an example. This is the easiest way to understand what he's talking about here. Let's look at courage, a particular ethical excellence or virtue. In each case, a virtue has to do with a particular scope. In the case of courage, it has to do with feelings of confidence in danger. Or conversely, Aristotle says, we can talk about it as feelings of fear in the face of danger. The virtuous mean is that character state of rightly governing our feelings of fear with rationality, reasonably making the right, or reasonably having the right disposition about what things are fearful and what things are not fearful. So courage or fortitude is that mean character condition that will lead in the future to future courageous actions. The vice of defect is an irrational lack of confidence in the face of danger, cowardice, right? Being disposed to run away even when the danger is not sufficient to demand that you flee. Okay? The vice of excess is having an irrational overconfidence in the face of danger. That would be rashness. Okay? So you can see the structure here of virtue is that it has a right state, getting it right, where reason properly governs feelings, attitudes, actions, and desires and so forth. And then there are vicious states that have to do with the extremes to either side. Now, I'm not going to talk a long time about this, but Aristotle sketches out an exhaustive catalog of the virtues. And you can see the first one on the list. I know the print's kind of small, but I wanted to get it all on one page here. The first one is the one we were just talking about. Courage or bravery is the virtuous mean having to do with dealing with fear. The vice of defect is cowardice. The vice of excess is rashness. You can see other ones. Dealing with pleasures and pains, the proper virtuous mean is temperance, where in a temperate way you govern your pursuit of pleasures and your avoidance of pains. Notice Aristotle is not an ascetic. He does not say we should deny all pleasures, right? The key here is to rightly govern your pursuit of pleasure. And so someone who denies all pleasures, Aristotle would say, is not virtuous. That person is insensible. Someone who is excessive about pursuit of pleasure is intemperate. I started to give an example about students in basketball games, but I'll skip that. You guys probably can make that up on your own. Another one that is useful to point out would be down toward the bottom, justice. Aristotle treats justice in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics, and he talks about different kinds of justice, which doesn't really need to concern us here, but the key is that justice is a right or balanced disposition concerning things like the distribution of honors or making right a wrong that's been done. Okay, so in every case, Aristotle wants to claim that the way that we can think about moral goodness is in terms of this structure of virtuous mean, vice of defect, vice of excess. Okay, why would we might ask, why would we care about virtue ethics? Why would virtue ethics be so widespread in the ancient world? Well, there are a couple of things we can say about that. Virtue ethics shows that actions are important insofar as they constitute character states. But there's something very interesting to notice about this. In virtue ethics, actions alone are not the primary consideration. In other words, we don't judge the moral worth of a person solely by individual actions. What we want to look for is the overall character quality. So if a generally courageous person acts on one occasion in a cowardly way or in a rash way, we wouldn't use that as a way of judging their personality as a whole. In fact, Aristotle says something very strange about this in the Nicomachean Ethics. He says, we don't really judge the overall moral quality of a person until after that person is dead. Well, why would we do that? Aristotle says, we want to see the complete picture. We don't simply look at one action and say, this is sufficient for us to say, this is a bad person, this is a good person. Now, he does qualify that, again, in something I'll say later, so remember that. As I've already pointed out, character states, according to virtue ethics, are important because they dispose one to act in specific ways. And what this means is that, the next point there, you can see that in a virtue theory, the formation of character in young people is critically important in virtue ethics. In other words, Aristotle would say it's less important to praise or punish a child for a single action than it is to, over a long period of time, help form a child to have a good set of character qualities, to be disposed to do the right things. Okay. Now, what that means, too, is that in adulthood, you could say, focus on actions stresses the symptom over the cause. If we look at the actions a person engages in, then it's not as though Aristotle would say we shouldn't pay any attention to actions because actions are important. But actions are important in virtue theory because they reflect or are a symptom of the kind of character dispositions that a person has. Now, it's worth noting, many of you have probably taken Philosophy 301 here at Gonzaga. You've studied ethics. And you may know that lots of modern theories of ethics don't focus on character. Instead, they focus on actions, intentions, or consequences of actions. Okay? If you think of the great classic theories of ethics. Virtue theory really does approach the whole question of moral goodness in a different way. And that's a reason why it's worth are paying attention to. Now, what about a Christian theory of virtue? In early Christian thought, classical concepts of virtue were melded with the Jewish wisdom tradition to forge a distinctly Christian view of goodness and character. And what this involved, this is really very simplistic, I'm just trying to give you guys a big picture here. What this involved in a key way was combining the classical virtues with some specifically theological virtues. The classical virtues, especially the ones that were regarded as the most important, the cardinal or hinge virtues of courage, wisdom, temperance, and justice, were then linked with the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, which St. Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 13, for example. And these are supplemented then with other character qualities from biblical texts. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about this, but just some brief reference points in the scriptures. You can see that there's clear attention. I'm just picking the New Testament here. There's clear attention to the whole question of character quality. In the Colossians passage here, if you notice, St. Paul is just listing a whole set of character qualities that a mature and well-formed Christian should exemplify, things like compassion, kindness, humility, and so forth. In the passage from James, the Apostle James is pointing out that trials and difficulties are actually a good thing. That's a striking concept. They're a good thing because they help forge and define character. When we face trials and adversity, this testing develops perseverance, and perseverance then completes us, perfects us in terms of our character. The idea can be seen very clearly in something Jesus said, talking about false prophets in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. He talked about how you recognize a tree by its fruit. That is, if you want to know what the character of a person is, you look at the actions, but you look at the actions because they are symptomatic of the kind of person you're talking about. So Jesus was saying, if you want to know if a person is a false prophet or not, you look at their actions, you look at the fruit they bear, that's going to tell you what kind of character they have. So this replicates that Aristotelian link that we've seen between character and action and the priority of character. Because what we're really concerned about is what kind of tree, what kind of person are we talking about? We also see this in the pretty well-known passage, again from St. Paul in Galatians, the fruit of the Spirit, where he talks about a whole set of character qualities that are associated with our being governed by sin, the sinful nature, and a contrasting set of character qualities that are manifestations of the life of the Spirit within believers. Okay. In medieval thought, to make a long story short again, the works of Aristotle were temporarily lost to the Latin West, Western Europe, even though ideas about virtue still played an important role in Christian thought. But around the 12, 1300s, the works of Aristotle became widely available once again in the Latin West. And we find especially great thinkers like St. Thomas Aquinas developing systematic accounts using Aristotle's thought to forge, as I said, this kind of synthesis of classical virtue and Christian virtue. It's very interesting that if you look at very much art from the high medieval era, you find lots of depictions of the virtues. For example, a famous picture of fortitude or courage done by Botticelli that you can find in the Uffizi in Florence today. Now, it's interesting for our purposes, the purposes of what we're talking about today, because late medieval philosophy and literature was C.S. Lewis's academic specialty, and so a great deal of the work he did had to do with works from this time and also the treatment of how the virtues are explained and developed and thought about and conceptualized in late medieval literature. All right, I want to say something now. We're really going to shift gears here, and I want to talk. I've kind of given you a background of what virtue theory is all about, and I want to just briefly sketch out some key characters in Voyage of the Dawn Treader to try to show how understanding them within the framework of virtue ethics actually helps us to understand something about how Lewis is developing and building them as characters within that work. Of course, one of the key characters in Voyage of the Dawn Treader is King Caspian, who is now king, who appeared first in the book Prince Caspian. He is someone who manifests a number of the virtues. He exhibits prudence, for example, or practical wisdom in his willingness to accept counsel from trusted friends and advisors, like some of the nobles that on the in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader is meant as a search to find. One of the first ones he runs into is Lord Byrne. And the captain and the other men on his ship are people that he's willing to take counsel from. And he also shows prudence late in the story when there's a near mutiny, when they have sailed and sailed and sailed and sailed, and they finally reach the island of the star, the retired star, Ramandu, and the men are ready to mutiny. Well, he has a very clever strategy that he uses to convince them that they really want to continue the voyage, and all of them do except for one. He exhibits generosity and humility in small things and in big things. A small example is his willingness to share his ship captain with his guests and to actually stay for the majority of the voyage down in the hold in a dark room with no windows. Even though he's the king, he's willing to give this up and let Lucy use the cabin. He shows the virtue of loyalty in the very fact that he's on this voyage, this quest voyage, because he's made a vow to honor the bond of his father with these men who sailed out in exploration years and years before, and to try to find them. He shows courage on a number of occasions, as early in the story when he is willing to, in a fairly risky situation, with a very small force of men on his own side, to exert his authority over the Long Islands, which have turned into basically a slave haven at this time. But Caspian is clearly he's a good person, but he's a flawed person, and it's important to see that. Despite the fact that he's good, he has clear flaws, like greed and this is a spoiler, if you guys haven't read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you're going to hear things that are going to mess up the story slightly for you. I'm sorry about that. But there's a magic pool on Deathwater Island that turns everything that touches it into gold, and when he realizes what this really means, he actually tests it by sticking a sprig of heather into it and realizing, yes, in fact, now I have a sprig of gold. And you kind of see the stars in his eyes there. And he says, don't tell anyone about this. And you can see he's already thinking. Well, he says explicitly, the person who owns this island will be the richest king in all the world. And on another occasion, at the very end of the book, and this is going to play importantly in something I say in a moment too, he wants to go with Reepicheep, the very odd mouse that we'll talk about shortly, to the end of the world, because there's a sense in which he doesn't want to be bested by Reepicheep. That seems to be what's really bothering about this, is that the idea that Reepicheep is going to gain honor by this, by continuing the voyage after everyone else ends it and turns around, he doesn't really like that idea. In both of these cases, he's somewhat open to counsel by others. He's willing to listen to what people have to say, so that point about prudence might be relevant here. But he requires the rebuke of Aslan in both cases to really fully and completely repent. And so what we have here, I think, is Lewis is showing us a very realistic depiction of a person who is good in some respects and yet flawed in some respects. We see the same thing with the character Lucy, who, of course, plays an important role in the first of the Narnia stories, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. She exhibits compassion on a number of occasions, but in particular when, again, this is a spoiler, but when Eustace has been dragonized, when he's been turned into a dragon by laying on the gold in the dragon's lair, as soon as she realizes that it's Eustace who is the dragon, she runs to help him, even though, of course, smart people often don't run toward strange dragons unless they are very sure that they're going to be treated well. She shows courage on a number of occasions. Actually, you could say that her running toward Eustace the dragon is courageous, but she shows that on a number of other occasions, like when she's willing to go into the mysterious house of the magician on the island of the Duffelpuds. Particularly, I think one of the things that's interesting about Lucy is that she exhibits the character quality of faith and hope. And one of the most dramatic events in this story, they sail into a cloud of mysterious supernatural darkness. And everyone is frightened. Well, everyone except for one character, Reepicheep, the bizarre mouse, who we'll talk about in just a moment. But in that moment, she does not despair. She calls upon Aslan for help. And indeed, when help arrives in the form of what is initially a spot of light, and then a cross, and then she recognizes it to be an albatross, she welcomes it as a sign that that even though they feel alone in the darkness, in fact, they're not. But again, like Prince, like King Caspian, she is not morally perfect. She's a flawed individual. She shows vices as well, her envy and eavesdropping when she's in the magician's house looking at the book of spells. She's tempted to cast the spell on herself to make her more beautiful than any other woman in the world. But she, it's kind of strange. She loses interest in that because she sees Aslan's face on the page and says, well, I'll turn the page. I won't do that one. And then there's another spell to hear what others think about you, and she can't resist that one. And she does say the spell, and she realizes that people, of course, are not always kind in their treatment of us when we're not there to hear about what they think. Okay, and she's rebuked for that. She does complete that, but she's rebuked for having done that after she finishes reading the spells from the book. Eustace is perhaps the most fun character in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. The famous beginning line of Voyage of the Dawn Treader is, "There was once a boy named Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it." And as we get to know him, we think he almost deserves it. Well, no, we think, in fact, he does deserve having a name like that. He's interesting because he's a very flawed character from the beginning, exhibiting all kinds of vices of character, like quarrelsomeness, cowardice, spitefulness, bullying, and so forth. And Lewis tries to make clear to us that these flaws of his are at least in part due to the conditions under which he was raised. Remember what I said about formation earlier. For example, when he encounters the dragon on the island that has the dragon, he doesn't know what dragons are because, as Lewis says, he hadn't ever read the right books, so he doesn't know what dragons are. And in a sense, he's not completely to blame for that. But Lewis, like Aristotle would say, would argue that we are always, at least in some degree, responsible for our character. Even when we've been malformed, we still have a responsibility for our character. And the same is true of Eustace. And we can see this, too, from the fact that Eustace, given proper circumstances, he's able to be awakened morally, to see himself, to see his condition, and to understand himself as in need of moral transformation. In the chapter when he realizes that he has in fact become a dragon, the narrator of the story tells us he realized that he was a monster cut off from the human race. Well, this of course has a double meaning. Not only is he literally a dragon, but he realizes that he has been metaphorically a dragon for his entire life, and how unpleasant he's been in his dealings with other people. And that begins a transformation of character for him that starts in a sense of loneliness. He realizes he is cut off from and alone and separated from other people. But it has to start a long process. Given what we've said about character, Lewis makes clear it's not as though he has a sudden, he has a sudden conversion experience, like some people talk about religion, for example, as though overnight you become suddenly different. No, what happens for Eustace is he knows that he needs to change things about himself, but it's a very difficult thing. And one mark of that is in an episode when they have an encounter with a sea serpent, Eustace does something very brave, which turns out to be not very effective. He gets a sword and starts trying to hack at the sea serpent, and all he succeeds in doing is breaking the sword. So he doesn't actually repel the sea serpent or save them, but it shows that he really is capable of making a change, and that gradual change continues throughout the rest of the story. Now, I want to say just a little bit about Reepicheep here. There's a lot we could say, but I'm going to try to keep this fairly brief. He is a genuinely odd character. I mean, Reepicheep is very strange. For one thing, unlike the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he's the only talking beast in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Everybody else is human. Okay. He is courageous. Indeed, we might say outrageously courageous. But being a mouse, he's of limited military value. In the famous Battle of Baruna and Prince Caspian, he and a company of mice are able to actually fight only by jabbing the feet of opposing soldiers until they, in pain, start grabbing their feet and fall over, and then they do them in after they're lying on the ground. And it takes a whole bunch of them, right? All these mice with little skewer swords, basically. He's hyper-courtly. He's very concerned with formalities of manner and speech and decorum. But of course, you juxtapose that with him being a mouse, and it just seems silly, right? He has a grave sense of honor. Again, with him being a mouse, that seems very strange. You expect someone who looks very distinguished and has a certain kind of facial expression. We might say, well, that person we can see taking a distinguished and serious and grave attitude toward things. But a mouse with a sword around his waist and a little feather in his headband, it's very difficult. He often acts in ways that seem imprudently confident in danger and therefore viciously rash. If we go back to what we said about courage earlier, it seems as though he's not acting courageously but rashly. He often acts in ways that seem overly concerned with formality and therefore, again, it looks like he's engaged in or in manifesting the vice of vanity. Well, what does Aristotle say? Well, there's a particular virtue that has to do with the kind of character that Reepicheep is. It's what gets translated in Latin, magnanimity, or through Latin, magnanimity. In Greek, the word is megalosuchia, which if you just know a little bit and do a little etymology, you can figure it out. Megalo means big, right? And suchia is the Greek word for soul. The person exhibiting megalosuchia is a person who has a sense of himself or herself as a great soul. And what that means is it's a person who recognizes that he or she is due great honors. And Aristotle, like all of the other virtues, sketches out the appropriate structure for this. If the virtuous mean of magnanimity or megalosuchia has to do with right judgment about one's moral worth and of the honors due to one, then you can see there's going to be a vice of defect, humility, underestimation of your own moral worth, and vanity, overestimation of your moral worth. Well, if you're thinking about how this fits meshing with Christian virtue, you can see this looks like a problem, because actually I quoted a passage from the scripture where St. Paul talks about humility as one of the virtues, and yet look at what we've got here. Aristotle saying humility isn't a virtue at all. Humility is a vice, because it's an underestimation of your moral worth. What should we do about that? Well, let's think for a moment here. Aristotle says that what this character quality is all about is it has to do with the one who thinks himself worthy of great things, who is in fact really worthy of them. In Nicomachean Ethics, he says that. It's the kind of person who exhibits self-confidence, who is discriminating regarding honors. In other words, he doesn't care about unimportant people saying, oh, you're great. It's only important if people who are morally worthy themselves acknowledge your moral worth. It's someone who's fearlessly committed to great causes, who is transparent, who doesn't have to hide anything from others, who doesn't admit of moral superiors, who is completely virtuous in every way. Indeed, Aristotle says that magnanimity would seem to be a sort of adornment of the virtues, for it makes them greater and does not arise without them. You have to think about what he means by this. If you not only are virtuous, but you recognize that you're virtuous, then Aristotle thinks that's a good thing, right? It's not having a big head or thinking you're really something special when you're not, because if you are a great person and you know that, then you're in a better position to recognize your value, to recognize the tasks that are worthy of your pursuit, and to pursue them properly. That is why it's difficult to be magnanimous, because you have to have all the virtues and also be aware that you are worthy. Well, is it a Christian virtue? It would seem that magnanimity, which makes a virtue out of pride, a kind of pride, would be inconsistent with Christian virtue and the value placed on humility. St. Thomas Aquinas, in his Summa Theologica, actually states this as an objection. If you know the structure of the Summa Theologica, that's the way that Thomas proceeds, is by talking about, he states a position or asks a question, states objections, which oppose the view that he's ultimately going to take, and then he explains why he holds the opposing view. So he raises this as an objection. And you got to think about this. Thomas, being someone who endorses an Aristotelian outlook on ethics, is going to say, well, in general, I want to support Aristotle where I can. So he's going to be looking for a way to mesh Aristotle with Christianity. The objection is, no virtue is opposed to another virtue, but humility is apparently, we know humility is a virtue because we saw in the scripture it is, but humility is apparently opposed to the virtue of magnanimity, which aims at great things, whereas humility shuns them. Therefore, it would seem that humility is not a virtue. But Thomas has an answer for this, as if you've read much of the Summa Theologica, you know Thomas has an answer for almost everything. Well, he has an answer in this case and points out, humility restrains the appetite from aiming at great things against right reason. Remember what we said about virtue. Virtue is primarily concerned with rational governance over attitudes, actions, appetites, desires, and so forth. So if a person is humble and restrains himself, but it's not what reason would dictate in the circumstance, then that's not virtuous at all. Magnanimity urges the mind to great things in accordance with right reason. Hence, it is clear that magnanimity is not opposed to humility. Indeed, they concur in this, that each is according to right reason. And so what this means is that a lowly estimation of oneself is not in itself virtuous. Humility is not merely thinking that you are lowly. That's not what humility is all about, according to St. Thomas. Humility is rightly making judgments about yourself. And of course, that would include understanding yourself to be a sinner in need of salvation and grace from God. And in that sense, every human being should be humble. But not every human being should be humble in the sense that that St. Thomas is talking about, as opposed to magnanimity. If you are someone prepared to do great acts, and you are someone equipped to do great acts, then it's false humility to avoid those things, or to shun them, or to shrink from them. So, what about, how does this apply to Ripicci? While he's courtly and formal, everyone recognizes that his attitudes and actions are in keeping with his personality. I mean, everyone knows about Ripicci. If you think about the way people interact, or the characters interact with him in the story, they know that when he says or does something, he has the character to back it up. So is he excessive? Well, I want to say no, and for an important reason. We have a couple of episodes where it looks like he is being excessive, like in the Dark Island, as I've already described to you. There's this scary unknown, and people say, well, let's not go there. That seems like a bad idea. Well, who would want to sail into a mysterious darkness in the middle of the ocean? And Ripicci has something very interesting to say. So far as I know, we did not set sail to look for things useful. He's responding to something the captain said. But to seek honor and adventure. And here is as great an adventure as I ever heard of. And here, if we turn back, no little impeachment of all our honors. Notice how he's saying, how he thinks about this. That honor demands that we seek the great task. And the fact that the mysterious darkness is mysterious and unknown only makes it all the more challenging for us to pursue. An even better example of Ripicci's attitude comes when he's thinking about what lies at the end of the world. And this is a key part of the story. From the beginning, we're told that a prophecy was said over Ripicci when he was very young in the cradle, that he would eventually seek an adventure at the end of the world. And, of course, the end of the world is the unknown. What happens there? Who knows, right? Look at what Ripicci says. Yes, when people say, well, maybe the end of the world is just a ledge and the ship will fall over and that'll be the end of it. Listen to what Ripicci says. Yes, yes, cried Ripicci, clapping his paws together. That's just how I've always imagined it. The world like a great round table. And the waters of all the oceans endlessly pouring over the edge. The ship will tip up, stand on her head. For one moment we shall see over the edge. And then down, down, the rush, the speed. And, of course, he gets a kind of quizzical response here. And what do you think will be waiting us on the bottom, eh? Said Drenian. Aslan's country, perhaps, said the mouse, its eyes shining. Well, he sounds like a crazy suicide pilot here, doesn't he? Or perhaps there isn't any bottom. Perhaps it goes down forever and ever. But whatever it is, won't it be worth anything just to have looked for one moment beyond the edge of the world? Well, this just seems crazy in one respect. But I think Aristotle has a way of telling us why this is morally virtuous. He describes in another part of the Nicomachean Ethics the person who strives and strains toward what is good. The excellent person labors for his friends and for his native country and will die for them if he must. He will sacrifice money, honors, and contested goods in general in achieving a fine for himself. For he will choose intense pleasure for a short time over slight pleasure for a long time, a year of living finely over many years of undistinguished life, and a single fine and great action over many small actions. This is presumably true. That should be true of one who dies for others. He does indeed choose something great and fine for himself. It's interesting that this passage occurs in a section of the Nicomachean Ethics where Aristotle is talking about virtuous self-love, the right attitude we should have toward ourselves. Because remember, magnanimity has to do with a right judgment about yourself. Lewis has something that kind of sheds some light on his characterization of Ripachief. He says, "The essence of religion, in my view, is the thirst for an end higher than natural ends. The finite self's desire for an acquiescence in and self-rejection in favor of an object wholly good and wholly good for it." I think what Lewis is trying to show us with the character of Ripachief is that he is appropriately and reasonably committed to the great task because he knows that it is so valuable that even if the ship does tip up and he sees in that one exciting moment, there's nothing below me before the ship goes, then I have done the great thing. I have pursued the great honor, one that I was destined, in a sense, that I was called, that was my vocation from the beginning of my life. Now, how can we wrap all this up? Well, I think what Lewis is trying to show us in really all of the Narnia stories, but in particular Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I can go back to that quote from Lewis's preface to Paradise Lost, where he says, "When the old poets made some virtue their theme, they were not teaching, but adoring. And what we take for the didactic is often the enchantment." Lewis is undoubtedly engaged in moral education, but not in the sense that Philip Pullman thinks he is. This is not propaganda for Christianity. Instead, it really is Lewis himself's, it's Lewis's own enchantment with the beauty of the moral life being expressed imaginatively in this work. And he says something very striking in his work, Experiment and Criticism, that I think captures really his whole attitude about what the stories like Narnia are supposed to be. He says, "Since it's so likely that children today will meet cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. Otherwise, you are making their destiny not brighter, but darker." And I would suggest to you, that's what the Chronicles of Narnia are all about. Thanks.
I want to comment on four things from David's presentation. And all of these can be objects for discussion as well. The first is that I don't think the Chronicles of Narnia are Christian. And I'm fairly confident that Lewis didn't either. What is going on? Well, Lewis was primarily a Platonist. And he thought that goodness was a real thing. An abstract object. And that it could manifest itself in a wide variety of ways. One of which are the stories before us today. Another of which is the Christian story, the Gospel. And there are many others. Mystery religions. You have stories of dying gods, and so on. The difference among all of these, of course, is that in Lewis's view, this one is true. And the others not. And I think this is why there are a number of features in Narnia which are clean contrary to the Christian story, and which won't fit at all, but this doesn't bother Lewis one bit. He's not trying to retell the story. He's trying to capture the object. And his view was that was the primary purpose of stories and myths, was to capture these objects and convey them to us. Secondly, concerning children and formation of character. Here, I think David's fundamental point is absolutely correct. Lewis is very concerned about this. One of the problems is that he doesn't know anything about children. He didn't like children. He had no children of his own. His sons were adopted, and much later in life. He never raised children. He didn't like to spend time with children. And he had no knowledge, in particular, of the psychosocial development of children. What we know that he did not is that most of the elements that go into moral formation are completed a long time before the ages of the children in the Chronicles of Narnia. And this is one reason why, in my view at least, there's a considerable element and an odd mix in Lewis's treatment of these things of realism on the one hand and irrealism on the other hand. Because he doesn't know about children. It's notable, for example, that the children that we meet, the Pevensey children, in most of the stories, are approaching adolescence or on the verge of it. And yet there's not one shred, not one sign, not one scintilla of a sign of the main developmental issue for children approaching adolescence. And that, of course, is sex. There's no sex anywhere in Narnia, even among married people, even among adults. On the other hand, there's a strong form of realism about moral development. Here I want to concentrate on a couple of elements having to do with virtue that David made much of, and especially the character of Eustace, who in my view is one of the most interesting, as well as the most repulsive of the characters, especially in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. One of the things that's implicit in Aristotle's treatment of virtue is that it is not actions that reveal character so much as it is choices. He says, indeed, as much, that choice reveals character more than action does. The reason he says this, of course, is that the outcome of actions frequently depend on the actions of others. You'll be familiar with this. I call it the freeway effect. You're driving down the freeway in a crowded lane of traffic, and you observe that there is a lane next to you which is relatively uncrowded. And so, of course, you make the decision to change lanes. And just as you do so, 25 other people who were previously driving in the same lane that you were made the same decision. And there you are once again driving in a lane of traffic that's crowded with cars. And this happens all the time. It was the main, one of the stronger arguments that Kant gave for thinking that consequences could not be any guide to right moral action, because actions and their consequences are constantly being interfered with by the actions of others. And thus one can't calculate in advance what the actions will lead to. Now, I happen to think that Kant was wrong about that, as I think he was wrong about most matters in ethics. But it's a real phenomenon. It's a real problem. The other reason that Aristotle thought choices reveal character more than actions do is that choices have to do with deliberation. They have to do with what we are thinking and how we think. And what runs through the whole treatment of virtue or arete, not only in Aristotle but also in Plato before him and in the more ancient sources in Homer and so on, is right thinking. Thinking that is correctly oriented to reality. When asked what is the truth, Aristotle replied famously, to say and to think of that which is, that it is, and of that which is not, that it is not. To orient one's thinking towards what is real and what is true. It is notable that a part of this view is that there is something about which none of us have any choice. And that is whether we will have a character. Everybody has a character, and no one has any choice in this matter about whether they will have one. Where choice comes into play, of course, is what character we will have. Though even here, Aristotle thought that character, which he was pleased to call a hexis or a structure, could become so strong as to become inescapable. Even if it was a bad character. In one of the most frightening passages in the Ethics, he argues that the incorrigibly corrupt person is no longer able to change their character. and yet is fully responsible for what they have become, because, of course, there was a time when they did have a choice. We see some of these necessities played out, I think, in the Chronicles of Narnia, and this is one of the most, I think, one of the most realistic features of Lewis's understanding of moral psychology and moral philosophy. Now, concerning Eustace, we've spoiled the story for those of you who don't know it, but he wanders away from the group. They've been basically shipwrecked on this island. In the course of their voyage, the ship is a mess. It's been through a hurricane. It's been broken. The mast is gone, and so on. So they've got a lot of work to do, and he doesn't like to work, so he wanders off. And he ends up in a distant valley where an old dragon lives. He makes his way into this. He makes his way eventually into the dragon's lair. The old dragon dies. And Eustace falls asleep, lying on the dragon's hoard of gold and jewels and so on. And in good fairy tale fashion, in the course of his sleep, thinking his own dragonish thoughts, namely greedy thoughts, he turns into a dragon. His first action upon awakening, or his first sustained action, is to eat the old one. Later on, of course, he repents of all this. And then we see there's a remarkable event. Eustace is transformed back into a human boy. It's an extremely painful event, and it finally is done by Aslan himself, who drives his claws deep into the scaly hide of the dragon and rips it off. It's an extraordinary part of the story. No pain, no gain, as it were. And I think it bears considerable thought, not least because of what we learn about Eustace later on. When he grows up in Narnia, he becomes known for his wisdom, and he is called Eustace the Wise. He never becomes king, but he is the king's first counselor. Now, what has happened? Well, in driving his claws into the dragon's skin and ripping it off and transforming Eustace back into a boy, into a human being, one thing leads to another, and eventually the transformation reaches Eustace's mind, and his own capacity for good judgment is restored, or developed. It may be that originally he has no good judgment at all. And good judgment, of course, applied in a wide variety of circumstances, constitutes wisdom, which is what he is known for. So we come back full circle, it seems to me, to one of the things that Lewis is best at, and that is illustrating the importance of what Aristotle seized on as well, the importance of thinking to the moral life. And that's, I think, all the comments I care to make. Perhaps you would like to direct questions to David or to myself, if you wish.
Professor McClellan says, at this point in our proceedings, we invite questions from the audience. So, either questions for Dr. McClellan or Dr. Calhoun or both would be welcome. We'll stand up here.
Stay up.
Sure. I'm wondering how the argument for magnanimity works with the scene from Prince Caspian where Beefycheek has lost his tail.
Yeah.
Madeline's response.
I've heard that question before when I gave a version of this talk. Yeah. Well, describe the story to people that haven't read.
Okay. In the course of the battle, Beefycheek gets his tail cut off. He goes to Aslan and says, "Could you restore it?" And he says, and Aslan's response is, "I think you're a little too conscious of your dignity." And then the other knights draw their swords and are prepared to cut off their tails if Reepicheep has not restored his, and so Aslan restores Reepicheep's tail for the sake of his followers.
Yeah, after I was asked, I hadn't read Caspian. It's been a long time since I had read Caspian, so I had to go back and look when I got this question. And it strikes me that, and again, I don't have the passage memorized, but it strikes me that Aslan's attitude is very humorous and gentle with, if you look at the passage, he's not really, it's not a rebuke like these clear cases I've talked about where Aslan's face appears in the magician's book of spells basically to say stop to Lucy when she's about to say that spell to make herself incredibly beautiful. And of course, one of the key issues about magnanimity as Aristotle understands it is, if you remember, I said that it's a virtue in which you admit no moral superior. Well, of course, a Christian version of magnanimity can't have that element to it, right? Reepicheep clearly has to acknowledge Aslan's moral superiority to himself. And I think that's part of what the dynamic that shapes that interchange. That would be my off-the-cuff response to that anyway.
I think Lewis is also having some fun with Aristotle. Aristotle says a lot about the magnanimous or large-souled person. He says, for example, he speaks only of men, of course, that he walks with a grave and dignified tread, that he speaks in a deep voice, and so on. And, you know, this is just nonsense. And so I think it's a lovely conceit, which Lewis was fond in literary terms, for him to make the character that represents magnanimity in Narnia a mouse, who, even though he is large for a mouse, you know, he's about this high. Elsewhere, Aristotle says that beautiful people cannot be short, which, of course, is also silly. And there's at least a suggestion that this may apply also to the large-souled person. And I think he's just sort of poking fun at the heroic code, which Reepicheep embodies brilliantly. And is having this fun at Reepicheep's expense. I think he intended to restore the missing tail all along.
I have another suspicion about that, which I don't have any way to justify, but it's a suspicion anyway. I mentioned that Reepicheep, unlike many of the other stories in the Chronicles, in the case of Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he's the only talking beast that's present in it. And I think it's not accidental that the only talking beast in this story is the one who's exemplifying this heroic virtue, this dramatically heroic virtue. And my suspicion is that Lewis means to suggest, and I don't know if it's intentional or unintentional, I have no guess about that, but I think there's a suggestion here that magnanimity is a legitimate virtue, but it's an alien virtue to us in a modern context. We just don't understand. And that may have to do with either, cynics would say it has to do with the baleful influence of Christianity, or you could say it has to do with misinterpreted influence of Christianity, this misconception about humility that I tried to point out St. Thomas tries to rectify. I mean, there's a certain understanding of humility under which we should always, always say, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy. But in St. Thomas's view, that's a complete misconstrual of what genuine Christian humility is all about. And so partly, it may be the case that that Lewis is having fun, as Dr. McClellan says, with the idea of a magnanimous mouse, which, by the way, is a phrase in Shakespeare, and it may be that Lewis is playing with that too, because of course he would have been aware of that passage, and he would have thought that people reading might have thought of the idea of a magnanimous mouse being hilarious, and of course in the context of Shakespeare, it's meant to be a joke. And I think Lewis may be suggesting this seems like a joke to us to think about magnanimity in a modern context, in a modern Christian or post-Christian context, and yet it's a very real virtue that deserves our attention.
Two other things I'd like to add to that. One, Lewis himself was a magnanimous man, a large-souled character. He spoke with a deep voice, walked with a grave tread, and was extremely pugnacious. He was very argumentative. He would argue with anybody about anything at the drop of a hat, as Chesterton would say. And if you'll drop your hat for him, he'll argue with you. And he's very good at it. He was also loyal to a fault, compassionate, generous, and the like. But he didn't like the modern world very much. He was a medievalist by trade. And in what I think is one of his finest books, The Discarded Image, which was a set of lectures that he gave every year in Oxford, as introduction to the study of medieval literature, One of the steady themes in those lectures is how distant the medieval view of the world is from our own. And one of the ways in which it is distant is its love of hierarchy, political hierarchy, religious hierarchy, and social hierarchies. And we, of course, live in the age of egalitarianism. This is particularly notable for us Americans, who are deeply devoted to egalitarian views of society, culture, politics, and the like. Lewis just thought that was all nonsense. He had very little patience with it. And I think that's one of the reasons he loves Rinpoche so much. Because Rinpoche is the large-souled mouse and is given to a fondness and a love of rank, status, and the like. Secondly, I forgot my second point. Yes. Aristotle believed in the unity of the virtues. He believed that in order to have one virtue, you must possess them all. Happily for us, this is not true. Otherwise, all of us would be in considerable trouble. Aquinas thought the same thing. The unity of the virtues has a long and distinguished tradition, not only in antiquity, but into the early modern period. I'm fairly confident that Lewis didn't believe this. And I think one of his aims in Narnia and elsewhere is to illustrate the falsity of this doctrine. Because what we see are flawed characters, as David has put it, I think, brilliantly. And I look forward to the book that this could lead to in due course. I mean, it's perfectly obvious how it would go, right? We'd have a series of Aristotelian sketches of these major characters and what happens. But I think what we see is that even a wholly admirable character is flawed. And a flawed character can be wholly admirable. And while without saying so, I think he's mounting a criticism of the doctrine of the unity of the virtues. And here he parts company with his ancient and medieval teachers and masters.
Yeah. Dr. McClelland, I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more the importance of Lewis as being not familiar with children and the point you made about not particularly liking them, especially given your point about the fact that the main characters in the books are past the formative years. And my question, I think, is dealing with particularly the fact that the target audience in this book are presumably in their formative years. So I was wondering if you had any comments about that.
Oh, no, I don't think they're in their formative years. The target audience of this book is the children of the age of the Pevensies, 9 to 12 year olds. And most formation of the personality is complete long before that, within the first 5 years of life. And I think Lewis's general view is unrealistic in this regard. He sees these children as much more unformed than we know them to be. Now, on the other hand, he has lovely treatment of what it's like to be a child, in a family, what it's like to be a child in school, and so on. And he's very realistic about the fact that people hate each other, that they get angry with each other. Eustace betrays his brother and sisters. He betrays them to potential death. And they face this squarely in their treatment of their brother in due course. And
I meant Edmund,
in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yeah. And that's the sort of thing he's willing to take on, and again, he's very realistic about that. So it's a funny kind of mix. You get very realistic, what I would call moral psychology going on. At the same time, there's an awful lot we know going on that he just doesn't know anything about. And I don't think it's an accident either. Lewis suffered serious emotional trauma as a child, especially with the death of his beloved mother. And it happened at the age of the Pevensey children. And he was never able to make a good, solid emotional contact with his father, though he desperately needed it and desperately tried to do it. And he has almost no insight into the way in which these things affected him and affected him throughout the rest of his life. To the point of making an extraordinary, one of the most bizarre marriages I've ever heard about or read about. And having very odd relationships with women, in general. He did not take women students. He didn't like them, and so on. And so we see, again, I mean, in his own case, we see excellence and flaw as well. That's about all I have to say about that.
It might, I would agree with most of what Dr. McClellan said. It might be helpful to know that the primary school of psychology that was prevalent in, or at least was the major contender in Lewis's time, was Freudian. And Lewis was extremely anti-Freudian because of its deterministic implications. And it may be that he actually is reacting in his failure to see the degrees to which children are shaped and formed at an earlier age is really a rebellion against, or at least what he takes to be Freudianism. And I guess I would add to that, too, just that I could agree with Dr. McClellan's point about we know more now biologically and in terms of neurophysiology about formation and settling of personality and so forth. But Lewis, I think, would still say, and the stories of moral transformation, like Edmund in the case of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Eustace in the case of Voyage of the Dawn Treader, show that even when our characters are shaped or formed, we still have moral responsibility for them. I mean, if anything, Aristotle goes to the opposite extreme. Aristotle says that, well, and he's following Plato on this, that you really aren't in a good place to do ethics until you're about 35 years old because you don't have sufficient experience in life to be able to reflect in a systematic way on your motivations and your choices and to engage in the kind of deliberation that Dr. McClellan was talking about earlier. And so I think, I think it's possible to grant the point that formation occurs earlier than Lewis suspected it did, but still to say there is a place for openness to moral transformation, not only at age, I suppose they're around 10 to 14 or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, something like that.
Not only at that, but I think it's interesting that in the case of Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and you could say this about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, too, it's a crisis that precipitates moral transformation. Mm-hmm. People don't just change because they decide to be different. And Aristotle gives us very powerful reasons for understanding why that's the case. The character you have disposes you to your choices and your actions for the future. And it takes a very radical catastrophe for that to be altered, for that feedback mechanism to be altered in any significant way.
Well, let me play the other side of the street. Here are two things that David's mentioned, which Lewis, I think, is very good about. One is this notion that what prompts transformation is crisis. That's a principle of developmental psychology, that there are a series of developmental crises which are natural, normal to the growing and aging human being, including adults. The famous midlife crisis, or the age 60 crisis. And so on. And there are a series of them, one of which, of course, is adolescence. And who would do that again voluntarily, right? There's a circle in hell that says adolescence, and you get to go there, and when you're done with it, they say, now you get to do it again. And that's a deep, profound psychological truth to understand that what prompts transformation is crisis, and that crisis normally requires transformation as well for its resolution. Secondly, David's quite right. I mean, and I don't wish to imply that moral development, especially, is complete by the time a person is 5 years old. Nothing could be further from the truth. But a great deal more is finished and complete than Lewis knows or allows for. That's all. But certainly, the process of growth and development continues. Indeed, it's a lifelong project, as we know. Everybody's involved in this, and we're involved in it from the beginning to the end. I like wonderfully in the treatment of Eustace the fact that his transformation requires his cooperation with what Aslan is doing and that it demands suffering on his part. Very profound suffering. He gets his skin ripped off. you know what that's like. Occasionally you've had small pieces of skin that got ripped off, right? On the basketball court or the playground or wherever. He gets his skin ripped off. And one of the things I dislike heartily, especially about contemporary medium, especially film, which I otherwise love to death, is the tackiness of moral transformation, which is normally treated as if it were easy and required little effort. The medievals had a notion called the arduum bonum, the good of difficult achievement. And I think that's what Lewis illustrates over and over again. And that, I think, he is brilliant at. In a way that's very simple, very straightforward, that a child could understand, and that's very realistic.
Mark? Dr. Carter, you said that Lewis didn't have much contact with children. Do you think it's possible that one of the reasons he seemed to place this his stories with older, slightly older children was that he's drawing mostly from his own memories of childhood, and so...
Yes, yes.
So that way, obviously, he wouldn't be remembering back to when he was five.
Yeah. Well, no, I think he's harking back especially to his relationship with his brother. With his older brother, Major Lewis. And when they were children together growing up, they invented a fairy tale world. They called it Boxen, and they wrote stories about it all the time. And they put on little plays and so on. And this fantasy development occupied a great deal of their time. And they had a lot of time on their hands in this house that they lived in. And he says as much especially when he talks about his brother, whom he loved dearly, and who outlived him. He was a tragic figure, a fine historian, and a career army officer, who was also an alcoholic, and his alcoholism finally killed him. They lived together later as adults after his brother retired from the army. They set up housekeeping together. This was before Lewis's marriage. And indeed, one of the issues about the marriage was how is that going to fit in to this dyad that they had formed as brothers living together. And so I think what he's done is he's gone back to that. And I like very much David's introduction where he gives that comment about Lewis writing the books that he wanted to read. Well, he's going back to this period of great inventiveness that he and his brother did at about the age of the Pevensey children. From about, say, age 8 into early adolescence, when they got sent away to school, and so on.
So perhaps that's why some of the character development seems to happen later.
I think it's very plausible to say that, yeah. And it's clear he idealizes this period and this experience as well. He might, because it saved his neck. I mean, he would otherwise have been a very odd, a much odder person than he turned out to be. I think if he hadn't had this older brother who loved him and who cared for him, with whom he formed a rich and wonderful and lifelong friendship.
You stated at the beginning that you don't feel that the Narnia stories are Christian. Although C.S. Lewis himself said that Aslan was what Christ would look like if you were an animal. So I'm wondering what you base that on.
David and I have had this argument before. People, when they say that they're Christian, they commonly treat them as allegories. And Lewis had a very particular view about allegory, a theory that he elaborated in a major book of his, The Allegory of Love. In The Allegory of Love, and in his other writings about mythology and about stories in particular, he continually advances this claim that the purpose of story is to capture abstract qualities and properties of things and convey them to us in a concrete fashion. And that's why I make the claim about Narnia, that it is one of many stories that conveys to us the quality of goodness. And we say, well, you know, what about the obvious parallels? When you have Aslan is the son of the emperor over the sea, and he dies and comes back to life, and so on. Well, this is a pattern that Lewis knew from his study of the history of religions. It appears in many, many, many places, as well as in the Christian story. The difference, of course, is that in Lewis's view, the Christian story is true. The other stories are not. Now, they're false in literal terms on his view of them, right? But they are metaphorically true because they convey to us these qualities of goodness. And it seems to me that that view is what trumps and explains the connections between what happens in Narnia and the Christian gospel.
How do you reconcile then his claim that it was a Christian proposal?
A Christian what?
Proposal?
I don't quite understand what you're saying.
That's a technical term that he uses to say, what if, he says the same thing, again, it's in his discussion about fairy stories and so forth and fantasy, that it's a supposal about what could happen were God to become incarnate in a world very unlike our own.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I really think there's a sense in which Dr. McClellan and my conversation on this point is partially semantic, because when I say that it's Christian, I don't mean that it's allegorical, so I would agree with you about that. He isn't saying that, and a lot of people read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe allegorically this way, where they say Aslan is Jesus, the sacrifice on the stone table is the cross, and what happens is when you read any of the other books in the Chronicles, you're stumped because there's no such one-to-one correspondence with anything, right? And Lewis himself used this idea of a supposal, that this tells what would happen or what might happen were God to appear in a world very much very unlike our own. And the same would be true of say Perelandra in the Space Trilogy. What would creation look like in a world unlike ours when there is not a fall? And I'm sympathetic to this idea about Lewis's Platonism, because there's no doubt that Lewis is a Christian Platonist, I would say. What I would say about the semantic distinction between us is, I certainly don't mean it's a piece of Christian propaganda. I think on that point, strangely enough, a so-called fundamentalist reading of the Chronicles of Narnia is the same reading that Philip Pullman has.
Yeah.
And I would like to avoid that one personally. Because I think it's ham-handed and it's not very sophisticated or reflective. It's certainly, if what you mean, what I mean by saying that the Chronicles are Christian is that they reflect Lewis's own imagination, his own Christian imagination. And so they're not going to fall into a one-to-one allegorical correspondence. And they're actually going to take us in some directions, as Dr. McClellan has already pointed out, they're going to take us in some directions that are going to be kind of difficult to square with some key elements of Christianity. Many readers would say that about Reepicheep, which is why I wanted to make this kind of extended argument at the end of my talk about Reepicheep in particular, whereas I think he is a case where Lewis has in mind a Christian view of the classical virtues, and he actually is trying to say something kind of humorous and also creatively powerful at the same time. So I would say, yes, they're Christian, but certainly, Lewis himself talks in these terms when he talks about his fascination with the great Norse legends and the fact that they are populated with these stories of dying gods and resurrections and so forth. And Lewis would say, well, isn't it interesting that the human imagination comes up with the right story even apart from revelation, that God somehow plants, this is the way Lewis would talk about this, that God plants in the human imagination a sense of what's really true. And so those myths are, as Dr. McClellan said, on Lewis's view, they're true, not literally, but they're true in the sense that they clue us into what the real story is all about. And so in that sense, well, in an expanded sense, I would actually say you could argue that the Norse myths are Christian just as well as the Chronicles of Narnia are, which would invert the objection that you were making. Other questions? Comments? Yeah, go ahead.
Just when you're talking about other kinds of stories portraying a truth aside from a literal truth, and here you have written up this this assertion that you have this abstract object, goodness, being portrayed. Are you saying, or are you suggesting that Lewis would propose that portraying goodness is the same thing as portraying a truth? Or are those separate concepts?
Well, I suppose what he would say is he wants to say something that is true about goodness. as David put it, I think absolutely rightly, Lewis is a Platonist. He's a thoroughgoing Platonist. He learned a lot from Aristotle about ethics, but he didn't learn very much from him about metaphysics. He, especially in the essays and other places where he talks about mythology, I think this comes through most clearly. And at one point he calls a myth or a good story is a net. It means like a butterfly net for capturing abstract qualities of things. He was interested in all kinds of qualities. He was interested in qualities about love, about hatred, many different kinds of emotions. He was interested in qualities about goodness. Now, of course, because Lewis is a Christian, he thinks that the Christian story is more profound and more finally true than any other story about the nature of goodness. But he's perfectly happy and perfectly willing to be very eclectic about what stories he gathers together to talk about the qualities of goodness. And the Chronicles of Narnia, the stories about Narnia, are among them. And he didn't really care where they came from. Pagan sources, ancient sources, medieval sources, didn't matter to him. And just as it is possible to think things which are false about the nature of goodness, it's also possible to think things that are true, and that's what he wants to do. At least that would be my view of it. Now, he had a very odd view, by the way, about allegory, and the allegory of the love has the allegory of love, that book of his, has not stood up well over time. Most people don't buy his treatment of allegory. He thought allegory had to do with the personification of emotions in particular. And that's probably the strongest reason for thinking he would reject the view that Narnia is an allegory. I think myself that view of allegory is flawed. But yeah, I think David's right that we're not that far apart in our views here.
Oh, well, we're out of time. Thanks again for coming. We're glad that you came to the Strive Club today. Our next view.